That's great. That's Lee Morgan with the Sidewinder. Lee Morgan, of course, on trumpet, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Billy Higgins on drums, the great Barry Harris on piano, and Bob Cranshaw on bass. A really incredible team. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, February the 25th. And yes, it's about the Great Sequester. They had their break, so they made sure that we won't get one. But we'll get to that in the second half of our program. We'll take a look from the point of view of the Economic Policy Institute as to what these folks on Capitol Hill are missing. But first, a couple of items to bring to your attention. In Washington, of course, it's the blame game. And Congress passed and the president signed the 2011 Budget Control Act. All parties agreed that the act's $1.2 trillion in sequester cuts over 10 years would be so drastic that a bipartisan super committee would be forced to present a better plan for deficit reduction. So did it happen? Oh, no, it didn't happen. The act mandated $85 billion in cuts this year, $46 billion from the Pentagon, and $39 billion in discretionary spending that would require across-the-board cuts in every agency. That's what they mean by the sequester. Now, with a March 1 deadline approaching, and by which time the cuts automatically go into effect, all we're hearing from Washington is noise, noise, and more noise about which party is to be blamed for not coming up with a budget plan. They can't come to terms. Why? Well, they would have to believe that it's all about tough negotiations and brinksmanship and the like. Everybody's, you know, cussing out the other. The fact is, both sides clearly agree that the last thing they want with midterm elections around the corner is to have budget cuts sour voters on their respective parties. But politics, as you know, is all about the art of double talk. For example, here's President Barack Obama in November of 2011, just last year, favoring spending cuts.
Already, some in Congress are trying to undo these automatic spending cuts. My message to them is simple. No, I will veto any effort to get rid of those automatic spending cuts to domestic and defense spending. There will be no easy off-ramps on this one.
That sounds pretty straightforward. He will veto any attempt. But here's what he said on February the 19th, just last Tuesday.
Emergency responders, like the ones who are here today, their ability to help communities respond to and recover from disasters will be degraded. Border Patrol agents will see their hours reduced. FBI agents will be furloughed. Federal prosecutors will have to close cases and let criminals go. Air traffic controllers and airport security will see cutbacks, which means more delays at airports across the country. Thousands of teachers and educators will be laid off. Tens of thousands of parents will have to scramble to find childcare for their kids. Hundreds of thousands of Americans will lose access to primary care and preventive care, like flu vaccinations and cancer screenings. And already the threat of these cuts has forced the Navy to delay an aircraft carrier that was supposed to deploy to the Persian Gulf. And as our military leaders have made clear, changes like this, not well thought through, not phased in properly, changes like this affect our ability to respond to threats in unstable parts of the world. So these cuts are not smart, they are not fair, they will hurt our economy, they will add hundreds of thousands of Americans to the unemployment rolls. This is not an abstraction. People will lose their jobs. The unemployment rate might tick up again.
Well, so I think I missed something. I think I heard in the first part that he favored cuts, and now I'm hearing that he does not favor cuts. And it's hard to tell what politicians really mean when there are so many levels of meaning to what they say. So we'll find out from President Obama and the Republicans sometime this week. We have until Friday to see what they come up with, our esteemed leaders. Let's see what they come up with as a plan that would work. But in the meantime, of course, it's all about scaring the bejesus out of everybody, about doom and gloom. Everything is going to, the sky's going to fall in and everything is going to be awful. But I think we're clear. This is not our fault. These guys, they are the ones who agreed to do this last year. They were in agreement, then get it solved. It's just, this is the time to show your leadership now and come up with a plan, since you both agreed, both sides agreed to this last year. Speaking of sequester cuts, let's talk about Jack Lew, the former director of the Office of Management and Budget, who played a key role in the creation of the sequester. He again appears before the Senate Finance Committee tomorrow in his quest to be named Treasury Secretary. And, of course, we have heard the chorus already that he is not qualified for the job. What's new? When he appeared before the committee before the one-week break that they just are coming back from, Lew answered several times what Clinton said when he was questioned. I do not recall, he said to many of the questions asked him, a string of questions yielded, I do not recall, as his response. He was asked about an interesting pattern in the last two jobs he held before returning to government. Those two jobs were as executive vice president at New York University and as a senior executive at Citicorp. NYU paid Lew a, quote, severance, unquote, of $1.4 million, although he voluntarily left the job in 2005 to take the job at Citigroup. And his contract with Citigroup included an unexplained bonus guarantee of almost $1 million if he left the bank. You have to really believe this. If he left the bank for a high-level position within the United States government or regulatory body. Isn't that interesting? You get a severance for voluntarily leaving, and you get another bonus if you should just so happen, should you happen at some point in the future, to land yourself a high-level position with the United States government or regulatory body. The Wall Street Journal said something interesting just yesterday. It said, NYU hasn't explained why it would pay someone for quitting to take a job on Wall Street. When Lew was at NYU, the university just happened to be the subject of an investigation by the New York Attorney General's office for steering pricey student loans to Citigroup as a preferred lender. And NYU settled that suit in 2007 and agreed to return $1.4 million to students on the condition that it didn't have to admit guilt. See, this is how it works. You and me and ordinary folks, we get kicked in the teeth. These folks, just a little settlement. You know, we pay the money back and all will be forgotten and forgiven. Well, it doesn't stop there. The Wall Street Journal said that it has noted an especially nice landing, that Citigroup has become especially nice landing for big shot Democrats. Former White House Budget Director Peter Orszag is now a Citigroup vice chairman and somehow finds time to write a column for Bloomberg News. And there was former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, that's Jack Lew's mentor, who was paid more than $115 million while encouraging the risk-taking that would have destroyed Citi were it not for a taxpayer rescue. In other words, Lou's mentor actually was paid $115 million while the government was bailing out the bankrupt Citi group. Isn't that interesting? Fascinating. The obvious reference in this all is that both with respect to NYU and Citigroup is that Liu's appointment to Treasury Secretary was long in the making. And NYU and Citigroup were expressing, through these generous offers to him, expressing a wish to be thought of very kindly when he gets his job. But Republicans couldn't resist the urge to flog the president's former chief of staff publicly about a major peeve that it has, and that is Benghazi. Here's Senator Richard Burr, Republican of North Carolina, zeroing in.
Jack, in the Armed Services hearing last week, Secretary Panetta testified that following his and General Dempsey's 5 o'clock meeting on September the 11th after the Benghazi attack, they had no further contact with the White House, and it was their understanding that you, as Chief of Staff, were the individual briefing the President. Is that an accurate?
Well, Senator, I did speak with the President that evening. The National Security Staff was working on the issue on a nonstop basis.
But who was actually briefing the President? Were you?
I was not. I was in the room when the president was briefed, but I was not briefing the president.
Okay, because John Brennan testified yesterday that it wasn't him. Secretary Panetta said it wasn't him. In hearings, the ODNI clapper said it wasn't him. Acting DCI Mike Morrell said it wasn't him. Ambassador Kennedy said it wasn't him, and the FBI said it wasn't them. Now, we've eliminated a lot of people who had contacts within the intelligence community that knew firsthand what was going on in Benghazi. Let me ask you again, who briefed the president on actually what was happening throughout this seven-hour period?
Well, in the conversations that I was in, the National Security Staff was present, and some of the people...
Would John Brennan have been included in that?
You're asking who did a briefing, and that's different from who was in a conversation. I think if you ask people, were they in conversations, there might have been a different answer.
Who was your primary point of contact in the intelligence community?
As Chief of Staff, I didn't usually reach out directly to the intelligence community. I worked through the National Security Staff.
Was there anybody from the intelligence community in that briefing session on a continual basis, to your knowledge?
The intelligence community was in close touch with the White House, with the National Security team on a near constant basis.
Last question. If the Affordable Care Act is the panacea some suggest it is, why did the executive branch exclude themselves from coverage under the Affordable Care Act?
Senator,
Congress is included, staff's included, members are included, but nobody in the executive branch is included under the Affordable Care Act.
Senator, that is actually a provision I was not involved in the creation of. I'd have to go back and check. But
do
I
you
assume,
think they should be?
Well, I assume it has something to do with the fact that the federal system is something that is going to be accessible, in a sense, through the if there's a federal exchange. But I'd go back and check and get back to you.
In fact, my understanding is every member of Congress and every staff who works for a member of Congress is under the state exchange program. They're no longer part of FEHBP. My point is simple. If it's that good, why would we not make all branches?
Yeah, Senator, that's a detail that I'm just not familiar with. I'd have to go back and check and get back to you.
Great. Thank you.
In other words, they moved in on Mr. Liu, but we'll see tomorrow how much further it goes. Meanwhile, it looks like a rough road ahead for John Brennan and Chuck Hagel. Senator John McCain has renewed his threat to place on hold John Brennan's nomination as CIA director, saying his decision depends on Brennan's answers to his questions about the terrorist attack last September in Benghazi and his knowledge of waterboarding or harsh interrogation methods used by the CIA. Kane insists that he must answer these questions. As the administration heads into this crucial week, on a range of matters, all these fiscal matters, all these procedural matters, including the who is going to author the budget and how it's going to get done. Brennan and Chuck Hagel, the president's nominee for defense secretary, they appear to be very far away from a resolution as to whether their confirmation will be forthcoming. So here is Senator McCain yesterday on the State of the Union with Candy Crowley.
I'll switch to Chuck Hagel, nominated to be defense secretary. 15 of your colleagues, including Jim Inhofe, sent a letter to the president saying withdraw this name is just many reasons why he should not be secretary of defense. Why didn't you sign that letter?
Because I do not believe that Chuck Hagel, who is a friend of mine, is qualified to be secretary of defense. But I do believe that elections have consequences, unfortunately. And the president of the United States was reelected. I believe that it's when the questions are answered, and I believe they will be by this coming week, that the president deserves an up or down vote. Now, Democrats will say, well, we've never done that before. Well, they had, and they did with Bolton and with John Tower and with others. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't give Chuck Hagel an up or down vote, and I think we should.
As far as you know, is there anything standing between Chuck Hagel and that vote, a hold, anybody willing to do that? You think this will happen?
I think it will happen, barring some additional revelation concerning his comments about Israel and all those other really unfortunate things he said in the past.
Let me ask you about John Brennan, nominated to be CIA director. You have wanted certain information about Benghazi about that. How far are you willing to go to delay the Brennan vote in order to get the information you want?
I think it depends on his answers to start with. But second of all, we still don't know who was rescued from the consulate in Benghazi. We still don't know who made up the talking points. We still don't know. Mr. Brennan said that he was opposed to waterboarding and torture, but at the same time he said it has saved lives. I'd like to know what lives were saved, because the information that I have is it saved no one's life. In fact, it was a lot of misinformation.
If you don't get answers, would you put a hold on that? Would you try to slow down?
I think you examine your options when you decide on the information. But he needs to answer these questions. And they say, why now? It's the only time we have the maximum leverage. That's just a fact of life around Washington. But look, I don't want to put a hold on anybody, but the American people deserve answers about Benghazi. There are so many questions that are still out there, including, what was the president doing the night Benghazi happened?
Well, in keeping with the whole issue of the sequester, I thought we'd get an expert point of view, and luckily we have the expert with us. He's Ethan Pollack, a senior policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. His areas of research include budget and tax policy, public investments, such as transportation and energy, and macroeconomics. Thank you, Ethan, for joining us today.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Well, this situation, what do you think is accounting for the impasse? I mean, it's been on for how long now? What is the problem now?
Well, there's two overall kind of theories that I think are going around. One is that Congress is made up of children and that they're just being too stubborn to compromise. The second, which I'm a little more partial to, is that there's actually real policy differences between the two parties. And, Democrats truly believe that we should not be solving this purely through spending cuts, that they want tax increases as well, particularly on, higher income individuals, because spending cuts mainly fall on the middle class, and they feel like they've been, that they've been in pain for a long time now, and Republicans are very opposed to any type of tax increases. So that's kind of the divide that you see here, and I think that it's the type of thing where, both are kind of holding to kind of their principles here. I don't think it's a matter of kind of immaturity and they just need to get their act together, but rather that we really do have a big difference on within Congress on how to handle this issue.
You are with a number of other economics experts at the Policy Institute. Are you clear, or are you able to decipher what exactly is the economic theory the administration is following?
The economic theory, I mean, the economic theory, I think, generally is that right now the economy has a lack of demand, that people are not, that due to, you know, in large part, the 2007 housing bubble bursting and then the stock bubble bursting, that there's a huge amount of wealth, paper wealth, that was, you know, it disappeared immediately. And at that point, it was about $8 trillion in wealth that was lost. And at that point, people stopped spending, or they started spending a lot less. That then created a lot of job losses. Those job losses then meant that people had even less disposable income, which meant they spent even less. So right now we're in kind of this vicious cycle, and what we need to do is we need to boost, you know, in particular, middle class disposable income, so they can start spending back into the economy, and you know, and then we can create jobs from there. So the economic theory here is putting money into the hands of consumers so they can spend money, so the demand will then create the supply, and that will then create jobs.
Well, it seems as if the Obama administration's approach is almost exactly the Clinton administration's approach, which is, you know, do some deep cuts in social services, although the president insists that that would not be the case, in order to, you know, hand over to whoever is next a pretty healthy economy. But the problem, the difference between the two, it seems to me, was that in Clinton's day, the economy was actually reasonably vibrant. Mm-hmm. And the Obama administration inherited an economy right in the pits. So what I'm asking is, do you see any innovation, any new ideas, any difference of approach in the way the Obama administration is proceeding with planning this economy? I'm not understanding it.
I think that the administration has taken a much kind of firmer line, or at least is a lot more interested in seeing near-term fiscal expansion. For example, one of the things that it won in the fiscal cliff deal back in early January was an extension of unemployment, emergency unemployment benefits. Back in 2010, when the Bush tax cuts were expiring and we extended all of them, one of the things that they had won was a payroll tax holiday. These are the types of things that, to my knowledge, the Clinton administration never pushed for very heavily. They were focused, you know, for the most part, you know, on deficit reduction. And there was a theory there that interest rates were, higher back then, and that through deficit reduction you could lower interest rates and you could bring the economy back. Here, there's very low interest rates already, so there's really no mechanism by which deficit reduction could do that. I think that the administration at this point sees deficit reduction as a goal to be strived for, but not the only goal that it has. It definitely has this goal of kind of near-term stimulus or near-term economic support, although I do agree that oftentimes it does not seem like it's fighting as hard for it as it probably should be.
But, you know, you take a look at the fact that this is year five, and one would imagine by now there would have been some kind of evidence of a mass employment plan. Did I miss it?
Well, I mean, there is. There is. I mean, first off, we had the Recovery Act, and then in over every single year, the president releases a budget, and in each budget, he's proposed significant kind of near-term fiscal expansion. Oftentimes, this has a lot of a lot of infrastructure investments and other types of education, R&D. He's proposed other types. He proposed a hiring tax credit as well. And there's a variety of things that he's proposed in his budget every single year that you could kind of characterize as a jobs plan. On top of that, then, in the fall of 2011, within the context of the super committee and what you know, trying to replace the sequester, which never happened, he released a comprehensive budget plan that included about, I think it was $400-500 billion in a new kind of jobs plan then. And most of those things have not been implemented yet. So that still remains kind of his position. Now, I think that it's true that he does not, with the exception, I think, of the fall of 2011, the president hasn't talked a huge amount about it. You know, it's in his budget, but there's a lot of stuff in his budget. And I think he can be rightly criticized for focusing in his rhetoric, so much on deficit reduction and really not on the job creation policies that he does support and he has proposed, but it doesn't seem like he puts as much political capital into them as I think at least a lot of supporters feel like he should.
Is that because you think he would lose points and to the Republicans who are saying essentially this is what the Democrats are all about? They're all about throwing money at a problem?
That's possible. Although, you know, a lot of the job, you know, proposals that he wants are actually relatively popular. There's you know, pretty broad support for doing things like making sure that our roads and bridges don't collapse beneath our feet. Shocking to say. So that may be part of it. May also be the fact that he doesn't believe that these things can really pass. The administration, I think, oftentimes is a little frustratingly constrains itself by what it views can pass and then focuses its political capital on that. And I think that they just don't really believe that a very large jobs package can pass, and therefore they're not devoting a huge amount of political capital to supporting that. Now, you know, critics could say, well, you won't really know until you try. And to his credit, he has tried at times, but nonetheless, I think that the fact that he does not see really a path to be spending hundreds of billions of dollars on infrastructure, education, all that stuff, I mean, how do you get a bill like that through the Republican House? I don't think they have an answer, and to be honest, I don't have an answer either, unfortunately.
Well, you know, midterm elections are coming up, and I guess what happening is that both parties are waiting to see who will make the first move so they can then go on and accuse that party of contributing to the problem rather than the solution. And the Republicans are hoping to regain the House, to regain the Senate. The Democrats are hoping to regain the House. So it's a matter of, you know, silly games happening. What leverage is there, or what legal mechanism is there right now representing, let's say, the power of the people to interfere and stop this nonsense? Is there any mechanism that gets the attention of the party leaders right now from a populist point of view?
So, you know, the next election is in, over a year and a half from now. But the campaign will really start in probably about, 8 or 9 months from now. That would be kind of the obvious candidate for the point at which the elected officials are accountable to the people. It does appear that the president is trying to kind of mobilize, have this kind of a outside strategy of, in particular for the sequester, as it hits, he's doing a lot in kind of highlighting a lot of the pain that's going to cause and a lot of the damage, in particular to middle class households. And to that end, it could be a powerful outside play where then that then fosters a lot of opposition to the Republicans, and they start maybe being worried about their seats. I mean, there's two problems with that. One is that the election is so far away that it's hard to see that they will be shaking in their boots for another year and a half. And the second thing is that so many of them are in gerrymandered seats where they're more worried about their primary challenges on the right than they are about moderate voters, that it's quite possible that the a lot of the kind of the wave of popular support, they just will not crash on them at all. So it's tough to see how the people at this point, within 6 months, really have any power in this.
Well, the United States is not the only country facing this question about massive debt and deficits and how to get rid of them. I was talking just last week. We talked about Bulgaria, where people just decided they'd had enough, and the president just decided he and his cabinet would just quit. The austerity measures being applied all over the world right now are causing a great deal of grief and stress in people. You mentioned that, for example, in the United Kingdom, their austerity measures are yielding negative effect. What is it that we could learn from austerity measures?
That's a really good question. I'm glad you brought that up. So the UK is a great example because they are very similar in many respects to us. They suffered from a very similar economic shock. Their housing bubble when it burst was very kind of similar in size to ours. Their central bank was doing a lot of similar things that our central bank does. Right off the bat, it was relatively aggressive. And on top of that, they print their own currency, which is a problem whenever we're comparing to other European countries that are in the Eurozone because they don't have control over their own monetary policy. But the UK does. And so what happened was from the beginning of the recovery, so the point at which we stopped falling and we started very, very slowly recovering around late 2009 or so, up until the middle of 2010, both countries were growing at about actually similar rates. They were experiencing very similar situations, which makes sense because our problems were very similar to begin with. But in the middle of 2010, the UK instituted this very, very big austerity package that in total equaled about 6% of GDP. Massive. And as soon as that happened, you immediately saw the growth trajectories diverge. And the U.S. kept growing at the same pace that it was before, which was a relatively mediocre, but, there was still growth. It wasn't what we needed, but it was certainly better than nothing. And the U.K., their economy just flatlined. And since the middle of 2010, they have not really had much real growth at all, whereas we have continued to grow, again, at this slow but better than nothing pace. And I think that this is a perfect example of how austerity can actually, another thing I should mention is that not only did their UK's economy not grow, but their debt kept growing because there's this complex relationship between debt and economic growth, where if you have more economic growth, then it's easier to get your debt under control. So because they kind of tanked their economy, even though the whole point of this massive austerity package was to improve their debt situation, what it did was because it tanked their economy, it actually made their debt situation worse. So the lesson here is that we need to be very careful while we have a weak economy from doing anything to reduce our deficit. Because if we do this in the wrong way, then what we can do is not only tank our economy, but we'll actually not even solve the deficit. We'll actually make it worse.
So do you think anybody on Capitol Hill is ready to listen to the logic that I know the Institute had also advanced, which is if you spend the money now, you incur a large deficit, but you concentrate on employment, in the end, it will work out to be to the advantage of the country as opposed to being a negative, because the people who are at work will be themselves generating income and taxes and so forth, and they will be contributing to an economy, and they themselves would help the economy stabilize itself. Do you think that it's just a matter that people hear deficit growth and they go into some other kind of land where it is politically just fatal to approach this in a logical way, even though economists have been saying, spend more money now. This is precisely the time that the country should invest in these kinds of programs. Yes, it would raise a deficit, but at the same time, it will begin to do something that the country hasn't seen in years, which is marked forward movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the issues is that it's hard to make the case, even though it's true. It doesn't sound right to say that, well, what we need to do is increase our near-term deficits because that will reduce our debt. Because people hear that and say, well, deficits then contributes to debt. So if you're increasing deficits, you're increasing debt. And the problem, again, is that, you know, these people are not taking into account how the increase in deficits and what you're doing with that money, which is creating jobs, can then help the debt situation, both by you know, bringing in more revenues, and also you know, fewer people are reliant on the social safety net, but also because the way that we measure debt is as a share of the economy. So if you're expanding the economy, then the denominator for the ratio is actually growing, which means that the overall relative debt burden is shrinking. So it's a hard argument to make. You need to kind of be as detailed as I was, I think it's an important one nonetheless, and I think that there is there's almost a certain sense among many people that, or at least a lot of people within kind of the DC Beltway, that we need pain. That, you know, we've been drinking for a while, and now the hangovers come, and we can't avoid this. There's a certain kind of, you know, moralism here, and seeing the economy as kind of this moral play, where it's important for us to experience this recession, I think is just both the wrong way to think about economics, but also I think it's horribly untethered from, you know, almost kind of masochistic. And could only really be, I think, articulated by people who are somewhat insulated from kind of just how bad the economy is right now.
Well, one little pet peeve I have is with the phrase the middle class, because the president talks generally about two classes of people, the wealthy and the middle class. What's happening to those people who are not middle class, or those, as he says, who should aspire to be in the middle class? What's going on? How does this budget approach deal with the millions of Americans who are chronically unemployed, or who believe they have little chance of being employed, and who are poor?
So one of the best things, and, you know, I don't mean to sound cyclical, but one of the best things that we can do to, you know, for poverty levels is to get back to full employment. It's almost this argument, instead of, you know, focusing on the micro level, which we should also be doing, but the most important thing we can do is focus on the overall macro economy. And by doing that, I mean, you know, there's a huge amount of economic literature on the overall benefits of full employment. And, you know, the poverty was lowest in the late 1990s. Now, why was that? Was it because of something that the government was doing with respect to safety nets? Safety nets certainly play a role in reducing poverty. But the biggest thing was just that the economy was booming. That we had a functioning economy, and that we're at full employment. Actually, probably even a little more than full employment. So the most important thing we can do for every American is to get the economy back on track. Now, that said, it's also important that we don't do anything to social safety net programs, because right now they're most important. They're being most relied on by, you know, lower income households, and, you know, both sending the economy into the ditch and then cutting the social safety net would be would be doubly painful for many of these people.
Well, finally, Ethan, could you prognosticate a little bit and tell us what you think will be happening by Friday?
Oh, my. Well, there will be a lot of freaking out.
Yeah, it started already.
Yes. So it's one of the issues here is that it's unclear to imagine, you know, when we had the debt ceiling deal, the run up to the debt ceiling deal, where the two sides were still far apart. This was in the summer of 2011, or in the run up to the most recent fiscal cliff. In both situations, you could kind of like look back and say, you know what, the two sides aren't coming together yet. They haven't reached some sort of compromise. But you can imagine a couple different scenarios. You can imagine a couple, you know, craft in your mind a couple different compromise packages, and then you can say, you know, one of these things would work. The issue here is that it's really hard to imagine a certain compromise package that might actually work. So it's not necessarily that politics are going to get in the way of an otherwise acceptable compromise, but rather that it may just be that both sides prefer the sequester to whatever the other side would be willing to accept. And in that case, then, you know, the only thing that may actually shift the scales is the sequester actually happening, the pain actually being felt, and then, you know, enough organizations and enough, you know, people start talking about all of the ways in which this is actually hurting people. And only through making that kind of the narrative may we be able to actually kind of shift the political discussion a bit. And it may be actually a teaching moment. You know, this may be a moment where the American people, you know, fully realize, you know, you ask them in polls, do you want to cut spending? And they all generally say yes, spending cuts are always very popular. You ask them about specific programs, and they don't actually want to cut specific programs. This may be kind of the time in which we end that cognitive dissonance, and we say, okay, well, this is what a overall top line kind of across the board spending cut looks like, and more importantly, what it feels like. And that type of teaching moment, that may have an impact. We don't know, but we've never fully tried it. So, but it's. That may just be trying to put a silver lining on an otherwise very cloudy day, but I think it's possible.
Well, thank you so very much, Ethan, for joining us and giving us this sort of primer. Of course, we're going to be calling on you again as we see the changing economic landscape, whatever that is, between now and Friday.
Certainly. Well, it's good to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, we have some time for your comments and questions at 888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Your calls at 888-874-4888 to comment on anything you feel like, including this little primer that we just did. It's going to be, I think, it's going to be between now and Friday, it's going to increase in intensity, getting people really, really, you know, freaked out about what's going to happen. And in the end, there's nothing we can do except make it known that this is not what we consider good government to be. I was talking about the fact that we really need a mechanism to shut government down or to throw them all out and start from scratch, to declare a no-confidence vote. This is outrageous. This is beyond outrageous to think that this is how the country is being governed in the 21st century, and they can't get an agreement. This is year five, like I said. This is year five. No, people are acting as if this is Barack Obama's first year. No, this is year five of his 8 years he will have in office. And to think that we are at the stage and there is just bickering back and forth, you know, I zap you, you zap me, and there is no forward movement. And in the meantime, people are suffering needlessly. And these folks don't really, it doesn't register on them that this is something they need to do in an expeditious way. Like I said, the Senate is a millionaire's club. Just about everybody in the Senate is a multi-billionaire. So they don't have to worry about the rent, and they don't have to worry about the utility bills, and should Johnny get sick, what's going to happen, or, you know, their pension plans and whatnot. They don't have to worry about these mundane things. That's what ordinary people do. And the ordinary people are stuck because although they are suffering, the economy is really not healthy, and it's not news. It's not news. But the fact that these people could take off at this time for a whole week to just, you know, get all rested up, play a couple of rounds of golf, and, you know, go to the movies and do nice little, you know, take a little mini vacation. The nation is going to hell, and they're on vacation. And the attitude is, look, we get to it when we get there. You know, we just get. I don't know anywhere on the planet where it is considered okay to not do a job and still get paid. You're not performing, and you still are getting paid. And you still are getting your benefits. And you still are getting your pension plan, and you're still getting all the perks for not doing the job. This is kind of lopsided, it seems to me. I just don't understand this. And I don't understand why it is that the Americans generally aren't in the streets. You know, we should be on several thousands of buses heading down to Washington, D.C. to get these folks' attention and let them know. That's one of the things that hasn't happened. I think the visibility of the opposition, the invisibility, I should say, of the opposition, is what is encouraging them to be even more atrocious and more brazen. If we had a vibrant population, a population that's really wired, these folks would come back from vacation and they would find the building surrounded. You know, they can't get into the building because you don't belong inside the halls of Congress. You're not doing anything there. Hello, Eric. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I talked to you a few days ago. But,
yes, sir.
Yes, I'm enjoying this conversation very much. I just wanted to make a comment that I think that there's actually a lot of agreement. I think both parties have actually agreed on so many things, and I think we're not really, you know, thinking about that. They've agreed on war. They've agreed on bailouts. They've agreed on cutting, you know, education, social security. And I think this is deliberate. I don't think there's any fight. I think there's actually more of a show, you know, put on for the American people to believe that there's the good side and the bad side, but there's only one side. There's the corporate side, and you know, at a certain point, we have to start looking at it in terms of this is a deliberate attack on everything we know in this country, and pretty soon there's going to be turmoil if this continues, and we're all going to be caught in the madness.
Well, let's see. You know, between now and Friday, we see a heck of a lot more. But, Eric, your points are well taken. Thank you for offering them today. Michael, you're on.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Yatrice.
Thank you. Same here.
I have an idea of what the Republicans have in mind, and I kind of agree with the last caller. It may be that the both parties have this in mind. I think they're probably not playing golf, but they may be very busy writing a bill that will come out after the sequester goes past Friday. Mm-hmm. Everybody will be in a panic, and they'll be in a position to stick something down all of our throats. And we'll be glad to eat it because you know, what's the alternative? They've frightened us up to this point. They've gotten us ready so fearful over a period of time. And they're going to let this thing go, and then they're going to come forward with the bill. If it's real, if there's a real Republican Party different than the Democratic Party, then maybe the Republicans are planning to let this thing go through and then submit a bill with everything they want. In other words, they're going to reinstitute the spending for a military, bring it right up to the level, and even increase it. And make those, but they're going to probably get, you know, say, well, we're going to make it up by cutting the EPA, and we're going to cut the, you know, the Department of Education, which we always wanted to do, or get rid of all of these consultants in the government that, you know, that they believe are, you know, absorbing million-dollar paychecks, and we're just going to cut the government to pieces. And then they're going to demagogue that bill, or you know, force Obama
just
to pass
ram it through. Just ram it through.
I think that's what it is. I think they prepared us for this.
I think you are right on point. Both you and Eric, I think you're right on point. Let's see how it goes. We have no other choice but to see how it goes. Thanks a lot, Michael, for calling. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I wanted to let you know that you can continue the conversation at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. And, of course, you would want to stay tuned right here, because Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. Thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. And I'm so sorry we had a little glitch with our clips today, but we'll remedy that. You're tough people. You can get through that. I did. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.